You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And those of you listening on radio, we are not blacked out today. We are, of course, you can't black out radio unless you just kind of make it silent, and that wouldn't work very well. But to those of you who are watching the simulcast of our radio show as television, and of course it's on TV, on Dish Network, on DirecTV, nationwide in, I think, 55 million homes and several hundred cable systems around the country and community stations, I am not a warlock. I am, the screen is very, very dark. The Tom Hartman Program is blacked out today, except for these four candles sitting in front of me. In solidarity against SOPA and PIPA, you can check it all out at TomHartman.com. If you were hoping to do research on the Internet today, you're screwed. A good portion of the web is blacked out today in protest, like our TV show, in protest of the two online piracy bills being considered in Congress. The Stop Online Piracy Act, or SOPA, in the House, and the Protect IP Act, or PIPA, in the Senate. Both bills are being heavily lobbied for by giant corporate media outlets, and that's why you haven't seen any mainstream news discussion about SOPA, PIPA, or these blackouts. Just hasn't happened. Because these are the companies that want this legislation, and they own most of our media. Or at least the stuff that, you know, the network news, shall we say. Wikipedia went dark at midnight last night and has since been joined by over 10,000 other websites, making this the largest online protest in the history of the Internet. Sponsors of the anti-piracy legislation in both chambers, in both the House and the House of Representatives and the Senate, in both cases, they're still pushing forward with these bills. SOPA in the House, PIPA or PIPA, however, you know, various pronunciations, PIPA, in the Senate. But more and more members of Congress are dropping their support amid increasing criticism from their constituents and online activists. And let me add, the principal sponsor in the Senate of PIPA, which is the Senate version of SOPA, these bills that would basically censor the Internet, that would make our Internet look like Iran's. One of the principal sponsors is Pat Leahy of Vermont, who's generally a very good guy. He's a Democrat. I'm not sure I'd call him a progressive, but he's close. He's generally on the right side of issues, and he's very much on the wrong side of this. And so, in particular, I would say if you are a Democrat, because this is one of the interesting things. As I'm telling you this story, I don't have any idea if Limbaugh is going to talk about it or not. You know, $400 million. Limbaugh is so much a part of the establishment that it's hard to know where he's coming out on this. But I know many of the smaller conservative talk show hosts, and many of the conservative talk show hosts are coming out against this as well. And so a lot of the anti-PIPA mail and email and phone calls that Pat Leahy has been getting have been from conservatives. And he might not take those as seriously as he would calls from progressives or Democrats, or particularly progressive Democratic Vermonters. So if you're watching or listening to us in Vermont, consider giving his office a call and saying, hey, you know, this PIPA thing, not such a good idea. Yeah, it's entirely appropriate that we have a conversation in this country about copyrights and patents. This is about copyrights. And in fact, the copyright law has been jiggered so many times. I mean, Disney was behind a major lobbying effort back a number of years ago when the mouse was going to be 75 and thus go into the public domain. You know, it's like save Mickey, right? I'm sorry, Walt was long dead. You know, his brain was frozen someplace, but he was dead. But they got the laws extended, and now they're getting these laws to be more and more aggressive. And I believe it's David K. Johnston wrote a great chapter in one of his books. I think it's an article on the web. You could probably find it, although today maybe not because so much of the web is blacked out, titled Bill Gates' Welfare Queen, about how Microsoft and Bill Gates use the copyright laws to basically, you know, that he's worth, you know, $30-40 billion, when in fact, had he not had this state governmental protection for himself, he would maybe only be worth $2-3 billion. So in any case, here we are. We're today. I think this is one of the big issues. And I think it's also a demonstration of the grassroots activity. The White House, by the way, has also come out against these bills. And probably most importantly, and I think this is really very important, this is the first time that there's been a major web-based grassroots citizen lobbying effort in, frankly, in the history of the internet, in the history of the country, as far as I know. This is kind of, you know, you look at the Arab Spring and all these things happening in the Middle East. And if it doesn't succeed, if we don't stop SOPA and PIPA, in my opinion, our internet may well look more like Iran's. When I was in Iceland, I had a conversation with Birgitta John's daughter, we would say, who was speaking directly to this issue. As a member of the European Parliament and the Icelandic Parliament, here is what she had to say. As a member of the NATO Parliament, as a member of the Icelandic Parliament, what's your take on what's going on in the United States and how that's going to affect Iceland and other countries if we go down the road of the SOPA in the House, Protect IP in the Senate, these kinds of things? Mm.
Well, you know, in many ways, it sort of reminds me, I work a lot for Tibetan issues as well, and I have followed a lot the development in China, for example. Mm. And it looks to me like if you pass this, the SOPA, you will become just like China when it comes to really poor legislation for freedom of information. And this is, it all started with the Patriot Act. And so I think the next big task for the Occupy movements and all these movements that are working for democratic reform is to remove the Patriotic Act, to remove it, because it has destroyed your First Amendment.
And here's what Jimmy Wales, the founder of the website we call Wikipedia, the institution Wikipedia, this is what he had to say on CNN this morning.
Well, for us, the openness of the internet, the freedom of speech issues are really paramount. The issue is things like DNS blocking, blocking overseas sites that have some piece of infringing content, placing all kinds of burdens on community-generated sites like Wikipedia to police everything that our users are doing in an unreasonable way.
Yeah, and that's I think, a good summary. Here's another statement by Jimmy Wales.
I'm a big believer that we should be dealing with issues of piracy, and we should deal with them in a serious way, but this bill is not the right bill.
Yeah, and that's the bottom line, which raises a whole other question. You know, Thomas Jefferson never patented anything he created. Now, this, of course, is about copyright law. To the best of my knowledge, he never copyrighted anything either. Certainly his letters is, you know, can you imagine if he copyrighted the Declaration of Independence? You may not reproduce that unless you pay my estate. And this is a guy who died in bankruptcy, keep in mind. He could have made so much more money had he simply patented and copyrighted things, but he didn't. Because he was of the opinion that when you invent something, when you write something, you are standing on the shoulders of the last person who took that idea to the point where you could take it one step further. That we all stand on the shoulders of giants. And I would say the same is true of me. It's why we're giving away two of my books on the web. You can read them for free over at truthout.org. Let's get into that right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Should we have even copyright and patent laws that last more than a few years? Jefferson said 3 years. Should they go as long as they do? And that's what's happening on the internet right now. Thousands of websites just going black. and on our TV simulcast going black. Well, going to candlelight, actually, turning off the studio lights. And SOPA and PIPA, call your member of Congress and let them know. I'm personally of the opinion that if you're going to have copyrights, that they should accrue to the individual who is the actual creator and not to the giant corporation that takes that creator's work. So if somebody writes a screenplay for a movie, that person should be the person who holds the primary copyright. And when they die, that movie goes into the public domain. If somebody is the author of a book, when they die, that author, that book goes into the public domain. And that's basically how it used to be. It's why there are some, you know, so many of the older movies that were made back before the 20s and 30s. You can get in a variety of forms now that, you know, they're out of copyright. And you know, right across the board, this show, you know, the copyright on this and things like that, and anything that is a creative effort. And that patents, which are manufacturing things, inventing things, I'm with Jefferson that 3 years is a reasonable maximum for those. That if you come up with an innovation, you can kind of lock it down for 3 years. But after that, it has to go into the public domain so that somebody else can innovate on top of your innovation. You know, ironically, one of the reasons why some of the nations that are coming up so rapidly are doing so right now is because they have so much piracy that, you know, people, that innovation is happening in those countries. So anyhow, that in the meantime, Willard Romney, Mitt Romney, is really struggling since he was called out by Rick Santorum in the Republican debate a couple of nights ago on his tax returns. And I find this hysterical. Let me juxtapose two things here. In the state of Michigan, you've got crazy Republican Rick Snyder, who is trying to decide, he's deciding whether or not he's going to literally assign the city of Detroit, take their elected city council, their elected mayor, and just say, you guys have no power anymore whatsoever. And he's going to take one of his cronies and put him in charge of the state and have that crony run the state and call him a manager, an emergency manager, and let him sell off big parts of the city of Detroit and privatize like his emergency manager did in Benton Harbor. You know, the juiciest properties, hand them over to big corporations and developers and other Republicans who will presumably then contribute back to Snyder's campaign. There is, by the way, a petition drive in Michigan to get Rick Snyder bounced out of office. It's a fine thing. But one of the things that he does, Michigan currently pays out roughly $34 billion in tax credits, much of it to big corporations, $3.5 billion of that, about 10% of those tax credits, of these goodies that are given to big corporations and very rich people in the state of Michigan. The Democrats in the state of Michigan are saying, let's just stop doing that. Let's stop subsidizing these corporations. Let's stop this corporate welfare. And instead, let's let any student who's capable of going to college go to college for free in the state of Michigan, as long as it's at a state university. In other words, we're going to make, just like California used to be before Ronald Reagan became governor, as much of the country used to be. It used to be heavily subsidized. My mother was a graduate. She's dead now. But she was a graduate of Michigan State University, magna cum laude. And she never would have been able to go to college in today's world. My mother's father died when she was 13 years old. Her mother worked as the city clerk for the city of Charlevoix, which was a decent job, but it was certainly not a highly paid job. She lived in a rented house in Charlevoix. And there were no savings in that family. The family had been my grandfather's family, even though my mother's family traces all the way back to James Madison and beyond that, and they at one time had a fair amount of money, at least some part of the family. In fact, they owned what was Hammond's Pond in Massachusetts. All of that was lost in the Great Depression. They weren't the very wealthy. But they were the bottom end of the middle class or the upper end of the poor when my mom went to college in 1942. And she was able to go through 4 years of school at Michigan State University. Now, you know, she told us stories about learning how to squeeze toothpaste tubes inside the, you know, in the where a door closes, what's that called, in the hinge of the door, to get the last little bit of toothpaste out, and how to use, you know, just a single piece of toilet paper very carefully, you know, rationing things, you know, because they just couldn't afford to buy them. But she paid her way through college by being a lifeguard during the summer in Charlevoix. Tuition for the year was under $100 or under $200 for a full load. So the Democrats in Michigan are saying, let's do this. Meanwhile, Mitt Romney is being forced to point out that while people like my mom, who, you know, even working as a lifeguard, would have faced, if they were doing well, as much as a 36% income tax rate, he himself, because he doesn't pay income taxes like the rest of us, he pays capitalist gains taxes. He himself only pays 15% income tax. And it's pretty mind-boggling when you consider it. I got a couple clips of Mr. Romney when we come back. So, a lot on the table here so far, and more to come. Oh, and Charles Grassley. You want to combat childhood obesity? Put those kids to work. He's right there with Newt. It's absolutely bizarre. We'll be back with more of my thoughts and comments, a little bit more news, and some of yours right after this. 27 minutes, guys.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Joe, kids working in agriculture, this is what Chuck Grassley wants, are four times more likely to die than kids working in any other profession. And this Republican loves this.
Black and white, the pictures of a life in flames. Black and white, the picture of a life.
So we've got this all these bizarre distortions of reality, or, you know, whatever, for lack of a better word, in the United States as a result of copyright laws that last forever, patent laws that are, in my opinion, overly draconian, that stifle creativity and innovation, that create billionaires like Bill Gates rather than a nation of entrepreneurs and Thomas Edisons, as it were. And the consequence of this is, frankly, not good. It has increasingly, over and over and over again, worked to the advantage of the big guys. Now, we want to protect the little guys. We want to protect creative works. We want to protect artists in particular. I mean, you know, musicians, painters, writers, as one of those three, I can tell you, it's a field that pays very poorly unless you're one of the, literally the 1% in each one of those fields who breaks through and makes it into the very, very top. Unless you're a John Grisham as an author, or a Pablo Picasso. Well, Picasso's dead, but an Andy Warhol. Well, he's dead too. I don't know who's a contemporary painter who's of that stature, but there certainly are some out there. I'm not an art aficionado who would know. Or a musician who's like, you know, the Beatles or something. But even then, in many cases, these laws are rigged in such a way that most of the money goes to the corporation. So meanwhile, so we've got that kind of distortion, and then we've got this other distortion, and that is that in the United States, we have two income tax rates. We have an income tax rate for those people who make their money working with their hands or their brains, the whether they're street sweepers or whether they're engineers or physicians or rocket scientists or janitors, whatever it may be, talk show hosts, whatever it may be, who pay a maximum 36% income tax because it's work. It's real work. And then you've got people who were born multimillionaires like Mitt Romney and who take that money and put it into the stock market. They invest it or buy companies with it or whatever, but they don't actively get involved in actually managing the companies. They just sit back. You know, Mitt Romney makes the joke about how he's unemployed. He doesn't actually do anything. He just, you know, every day goes to the mailbox and gets the dividend check and puts it in the bank. And so, you know, he's a capitalist. That's what capitalists do. A lot of people in America like to say, well, I'm a capitalist. Well, I'm sorry, you're not. You're a worker. The percentage of capitalists in this country is probably under 1%. A capitalist is a person who makes their money with capital. Capital is a fancy word for money. So if you make your money with money, in other words, if you make your money by investing money, then you're a capitalist. And we have a separate tax rate for that, an income tax rate for that. It's the capitalist gains tax rate as opposed to the ordinary income tax rate. And Mitt Romney, oddly enough, his ordinary income is from his speaking fees. And last year it was $374,000. If you make over $360,000 in the United States, you are in the 1%. That's the threshold point for the top 1%. $360,000 a year. And so he points out he makes $370,000, something like that. But it's not that much, right, compared to what he makes as a capitalist. And so even though he would be paying 36% income tax on that $374,000 he made as speaking fees last year, he pays a maximum 15% on the money he makes as a capitalist, because we tax capitalists at a lower rate. Not because they're more important, not because they're more valuable, not because they make a damn thing, because they don't, but because they've got the money to buy the legislators who change the tax code. So, you know, this, first of all, Brian Ross, ABC, did an investigative report on this, and here's a brief clip from this. ABC's Brian Ross on Mitt Romney, his wife, and all this. Clip number 6, Jacob.
Romney has not made public his latest federal tax returns, but financial disclosure forms required of all candidates reveal that he and his wife have had millions of dollars in offshore funds in the Cayman Islands and elsewhere, places that offer huge tax advantages to investors. The Romney campaign says he has paid taxes on all of his income, including the offshore investments, and the investments are now held in a blind trust. But tax experts say the fact that Romney's company, Bain Capital, under his leadership, established investment funds offshore in the first place helped them to attract business from people looking to avoid U.S. taxes. Romney's campaign says he may eventually make his tax returns public, but he declined our request to see them now.
So it's not only that he makes that his income is capitalist income, so he pays the capitalist gains income tax rather than the ordinary income tax for us ordinary people. But here's in the last GOP debate, how much should people pay Governor Romney? The top tax rate is 35-36% right now. How much should people pay? We don't, at this point, nobody knew how much he paid.
What is the highest federal income tax any American should have to pay? We're looking for a number. Governor Romney.
I'd like to get it down to 25%, but right now it's at 35, so people better pay what's legally required. But ultimately, let's get it down as low as we possibly can.
Yeah. Let's get it down. And he admits, and then he fumbles, then he pays only, clip number 7, that he only pays 15%.
Today they probably pay 15%. Very high income people in this country pay roughly 15% taxes if their resources are coming from investments, and under their plan it would go to zero. Pardon?
What's the effective rate you've been paying?
What's the effective rate I've been paying? Well, it's probably closer to the 15% rate than anything, because my last 10 years my income comes overwhelmingly from investments made in the past rather than ordinary income or rather than earned annual income. I got a little bit of income from my book, but I gave that all away. And then I get speaker's fees from time to time, but not very much.
But not very much. Ha, ha, ha. It was $374,000 last year, which puts him in the top 1%. It is 14 times the average American salary. Oh, it's not very much. Ha, ha, ha. And that's what he gets paid just to make speeches. He makes more in one speech than the average American makes in a year. Tell me there isn't something bizarre about that, too. So, anyhow, Beth in Altmar, New York. Hey, Beth, what's up?
Hi, how's it going, Tom? I want to say I love your show.
Thank you.
I enjoy watching it. I had a comment. Actually, I'm kind of fired up about a lot of things you're talking about, but my focus right now is the your question about the copyright and patent laws.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that, you know, with the internet, censorship of the internet, essentially, you know, so if somebody were to use a Fox News clip on their website, you know, to basically share the news, they could be shut down under these laws. And but they have every right, you know, Fox News has every right to come in and videotape anything they want, you know, and they don't have to ask my permission or my kid's permission to put it on the news.
Actually, if you're not a public figure, I believe they do. I could be wrong,
okay.
but I think if you're in public in a public event, they don't have to have your permission. If you show up at a protest, for example, they don't need your permission. But if they just walk up to your house and say, you know, what's your opinion of something, I'm quite sure that you have to sign a permission slip.
Yeah. Okay. My comment was about the patent laws. For example, Monsanto and other big genetically modified tea companies, they can patent life. They can create these mutant strains of proven to be very dangerous. And they're also heavily subsidized, and they also lobby a lot to the government to allow these products to come out on the market.
And this was a decision from our corporate Supreme Court, by the way.
Yes, and this is because previous to this, they were not allowed to patent life, and the Supreme Court decided, oh, you can go ahead and do this. In the meantime, they can go after farmers whose crops have been contaminated and sue them. There's been many cases in the U.S., Canada. There are farmers committing suicide because of, you know, low crops and low income in India, and it's been documented around the world. And the U.S. does not, you know, the people of the U.S. and the U.S. government does not regulate this enough. You know, they basically leave it to Monsanto to say, oh, we've tested it, it's okay, we can eat this. And they're heavily subsidized for the biofuel industries and stuff. And I'm a farmer. I'm an organic farmer, so I'm very, you know, I'm very passionate about what goes into our food supply. And the fact that it's been going on for so long, and this is one thing that is not talked about in the mainstream media because, you know, obviously, it's not something they want to be talked about.
And there's a whole bottom feeding industry too of companies that go to companies that have patents or copyrights that they're pretty much not enforcing or not using, and they buy them from them, and then they go out looking for anybody who might even be around the edge of violating it, and they sue them, and it's a low enough amount that they're suing for that these companies, rather than engaging in a lawsuit to say, no, what we're doing is legal, even though they're right. They'll say, okay, here's $25,000, go away, because they don't want to spend $100,000 on lawyers. And so
and most of these people don't have the money to take it to court either.
That's right.
You know, I mean,
that's right. So if Monsanto came to you and said, you know, okay, it's $1 million lawsuit, or we'll settle for $20,000, which are you going to take?
And I don't have the money to pay a lawyer to take Monsanto to court, and most farmers don't. And that's, you know, and this is how this is perpetuated. And right now in the U.S., we're at the point where the average farmer is coming on retirement age.
Yeah, you're right. Beth, thank you very much for the call. And we really, really need to be relooking at this stuff right now.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with your calls. We're blacked out today in solidarity, but with a few candles, if you're watching, it's like camping on radio and TV. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Dana in New York City. Hey, Dana, what are your thoughts on all this?
Yeah, the situation with SOPA, no one's really addressing the systemic issue that whether it's, you know, the white trash Koch brothers or it's the hippies and hobos at Harvard, on either end, nobody wants to pay for anything, and that's why we have a world full of crap.
Well, yes and no. One of the things that I can tell you as an artist, as somebody who creates works, is that when my works are pirated or given away, it actually increases the money that I get, because it expands the audience for them. There have been a lot of people who have quoted way beyond what is fair use in some of my books and articles and things. And, you know, under the law, theoretically, I'm supposed to come down on them, or I'll lose my my copyright. And you know,
as a breaking, the Supreme Court, they just ruled on Golan v. Ashcroft.
Yeah.
So they shot it down 6-2.
I'm not familiar with the case.
I'm personally involved in it. They were trying to turn down, roll back the GATT treaty, the Uruguay Accords.
Right. The General Agreement on Tariff and Trade.
The first time around, they tried the free speech tactic, but it didn't work. So this time they were trying the, suppresses innovation tactic,
right.
But with this conservative court, it got shot down again.
Right.
But it's a mentality of, it's like the kids like, well, they can, I don't mind stealing the album. They can make their money on the tours, touring. So how much damage touring does to the environment?
Well, like to the people who are doing the touring, let me tell you, having done a lot of book tours. But still, I can tell you when I went to my publisher and I said to Barrett Kohler and I said, I want to give away online a book that you are selling in bookstores right now on equal protection, the first and I still think the best book out there on corporate personhood and what we can do about it. In fact, the subtitle is How Corporations Became People and How We Can Fight Back. And I said, I want to give it away online. And they were, shall we say, concerned. But I convinced them, let's try this. Let's just try this. Let's give this book away online through the website Truth Out, and then other people will link to it. So it's basically available to any website in the world. Now, under SOPA, no website could link to that. But because that would be considered piracy. And it actually increased sales of the book. People were reading it online and going, this is a cool book. I'm going to go buy a copy and give it to my brother-in-law.
Yeah. Well, the thing I do some, fundraising and events with the gay and lesbian community here in New York. And as a result, I work with about 40 different fashion designers.
Right.
They're not in mainstream fashion, not to give, too much away. But the real hypocrisy with SOPA and the IP bill is that, a lot of the major pirators of the garments that these folks make, get sold on eBay by companies over in China, but
right.
They have no even under SOPA they don't
what you're talking about is
doesn't have the power. They don't have the power to shut down eBay, but eBay can turn around and try to throw a sledgehammer on top of them.
Yeah,
and make them prove that they originated that design.
No, I agree with you, Dana. And what you're talking about is industrial grade copyright and patent theft, and there are already laws on the books to stop that. And those laws, there are companies that spend an enormous amount of money trying to enforce that. And it's not just China, by the way, and going into many many countries around the world where piracy is endemic. And finding examples of the pirates and prosecuting them and trying to make et cetera.
Yeah.
We have adequate laws for that. In fact, I think frankly we have laws that are excessively draconian for that. But the problem is that they're not being enforced. And in many cases the enforcement is like in the case of your designers who are friends of yours that you're working with. They're not, giant multinational corporations that can afford to send 300 lawyers into a country to look for examples so that they can then come forward and say this should be prosecuted. And really, it should be the individual governments themselves. And we should be saying through our international treaties, if you as a government are going to sanction piracy and theft of copyrighted and patented material, then we're not going to do business with you. I mean,
it all feeds into. There's been a 30-year campaign of national deconstruction on this country.
Yes, of taking apart the middle class, taking apart our nation. Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Which we're resulting in.
It's called Reaganomics.
I get into this. We're getting the result is a grossly undereducated culture they can't work. Not because they don't want to work, but because they don't have the ability to work because there's nothing for them to do to get them, to develop that mentality. And
right. I got it. And you said
Newt's idea of turning people into, turning, 9-year-olds into janitors, that's not a solution.
No, you're absolutely right. Dana, very well said. Thank you very much for the call from New York City. Walter in Leesburg, Virginia. Hey, Walter, what's up?
Hey. Like Mitt Romney says, I don't make very much, $374,000. The thing that's crazy is...
That's just his speaking fees.
Yeah, at my pay rate, and I bust my butt every single day, it would take me, let's see, and my gross pay would be about $29,000. So it would take me about 13 years to make the same amount of money he makes in 1 year.
Now, and that's not the money that he makes. That's the money that he just makes from speaking fees. Most of his income comes from his investments.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's only taxed 15% on that.
Well, on the money from his speaking fees, he's taxed up to 36% because that's ordinary income.
Whatever. But he's making a boatload of money.
Yeah, you're right. He's making millions. He is making so many millions on his investments that the 36% rate that he pays on that $374,000 is being diluted down to the point where his overall income tax rate is 15%. Because he's giving millions of dollars away, principally to the Mormon Church. They get millions of dollars from him every year. And in addition to that, he's got all these other tax deductions. And it's mind-boggling. I mean, it's just mind-boggling. Mitt Romney is the 1%. This presidential election is going to be the 1% versus the 99%. FYI, several sources are saying that President Obama is saying no to the Keystone Pipeline.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, interesting, as we're watching this war of super PACs being played out with Romney's super PAC versus Gingrich's super PAC. Gingrich's super PAC, by the way, just released a 30-minute biography of Mitt Romney that is truly amazing. I watched the first half of it this morning. You can see it over at readersupportednews.org, and I'm sure it's in all other places all over the internet, and that's where I saw it. And while these super PACs are having wars against each other, and while the Stephen Colbert super PAC, which is now the not associated or controlled by Stephen Colbert, but run by Jon Stewart's super PAC, is running ads now in South Carolina urging people to vote for Herman Cain, because he's such an outsider, he's not even running for president, believe it or not. And so, you know, you've got the serious super PAC, and then you got the people making fun of it. And in fact, at the Republican debate the other night, there seemed to be a consensus that this whole Citizens United world that has been created is a rather bizarre world. Now, the Republican solution to that is to do away with all campaign finance rules whatsoever and simply let corporations buy candidates. So Mitt Romney could be the candidate from Bain Financial, and Newt Gingrich could be the candidate from Shell and Exxon, and Rick Santorum could be the candidate from United Healthcare, or, you know, fill in the blanks. I mean, you know, let's just do it like that. But the first real serious challenge to Citizens United came actually from a Supreme Court, the Supreme Court of the United States being challenged by the Supreme Court of the state of Montana. And this is now going to the Supreme Court, Montana versus the U.S. Supreme Court. Jeff Milchen is the co-founder of the American Independent Business Alliance, AMIBA, AMIBA.net is their website. And there's a link, of course, over at TomHartman.com if you'd like to learn more about it, check it out. And Jeff has been at the forefront of the corporate personhood movement for, you know, well over a decade, I believe. It seems like I've known you that long, and we've been talking about this stuff since around the turn of the century, Jeff. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Good morning.
Great to have you with us. So tell us what, you know, you, AMIBA, is going to file a friend of the court brief on behalf of Montana with the Supreme Court. Tell me about this case, where it's going, what's happening, and to the extent possible, let's keep this in plain English.
Sure. Well, we don't yet know whether the U.S. Supreme Court will hear an appeal, but the corporate front group, American Tradition Partnership, that filed the suit against the state of Montana will be filing an appeal. They've enlisted Jim Bopp, who is the lawyer for Citizens United and is the lead national strategist in dismantling all election integrity laws. So the case is being appealed whether or not the U.S. Supreme Court will deny the appeal or simply issue a summary judgment or actually hear new arguments in the case. That we won't know for at least several weeks. the gist of it, I'm sure your listeners have heard it before, but the case involved a post-Citizens United ruling by the Supreme Court, and then the Western Tradition Partnership, which later changed its name to the American Tradition Partnership, is a group that sued the state of Montana to take away and disbar our 100-year-old law that bans direct corporate electioneering. They succeeded at a district court level, but just a couple of weeks ago, the Montana Supreme Court overturned that decision and reinstated the ban on corporate electioneering. And they did it on two primary grounds. They distinguished it from Citizens United by saying that in Montana there was a very clear documentation of corporate corruption that was not present in Citizens United. And secondly, that the Montana law addressed nonpartisan and judicial elections, mm-hmm. which they said were not directly addressed in Citizens United. And that really is a critical concern, because the very justices who issued this ruling were aware that they could be tossed out of office by, or out of their seats, excuse me, by major corporations who disagreed with their views on such issues. So in part it was based on making those distinctions, and in part it was saying the U.S. Supreme Court had it completely wrong, and perhaps the strongest vocalization of that opinion was actually in, was from one of the two dissenting justices in the 5-2 ruling.
Right, right, who went on basically a rant about the, how the Supreme Court had this thing wrong, and was quoting some of the dissents in the original case and adding to them his long list, his bill of particulars from the Declaration of Independence.
Right.
So if this comes before, if the Supreme Court agrees to take, the, first of all, what do you think the odds are that the Supreme Court will take this challenge to their own Citizens United decision?
I would not place a bet on it. I really don't know, Tom.
Okay.
You know, all we know is that the Supreme Court is subject to flip-flopping back and forth on this, because one justice, Justice Kennedy, is always the swing vote, and predicting him is about as easy to do as predicting the outcome of a coin flip.
Yeah, yeah, or the weather on the West Coast. So, in the Northeast. What is, or the Northwest, what is the consequence of their saying no? If the Supreme Court chooses not to hear this, doesn't that mean that any state can pass a law that controls election spending within that state and that it will become legally enforceable?
It would, and we certainly hope that'll be the case. You know, before Citizens United, 24 states actually had bans on direct corporate electioneering on the books. In the wake of Citizens United, every state but Montana either wiped the law off the books or stopped actively enforcing it. So
right.
We certainly hope that Montana's stand will embolden the governors, attorney generals, and many other states to make sure that those laws are actively enforced again, and hopefully encourage many more states to pass such laws.
Right. So you know, to just kind of summarize this, used to be with McCain-Feingold and other laws all the way back to the Tillman Act of 1907 that there were these regulations and rules on how rich people and corporations could use their money to influence elections with what they called speech, buying advertising and things like that. And then the Supreme Court blew that up with Citizens United, totally blew that up, or largely blew that up with Citizens United. And the state of Montana had a law on the books that said, no, you can't do that. Corporations can't do that. And the state Supreme Court of Montana said, we're going to stay with our law, thank you very much, and here's why. And so in Montana, they actually have restrictions on things. The bottom line here is that this could be the beginning of the battle for Citizens United, yes?
It certainly is something
one piece of it?
Spark additional energy. And obviously, there's a tremendous amount of grassroots energy going into revoking corporate personhood at
right.
the grassroots level.
Right. MoveToAmend.org, for example.
Resolutions going on all over the country. But this certainly is going to reach a very, you know, different audience, the legal community, the all of the folks involved in actual running of local and state governments, and we hope this precedent will really inspire them to get more actively involved. And from our perspective as, you know, advocates for independent community-based business, this is a critically important ruling because, you know, it's not the mom-and-pop businesses of America that will be able to take advantage of this potential political power. It's only the largest corporations that have paid lobbyists at their disposal, that can spend huge amounts of money on campaign contributions, and they'll use that influence as they have.
Right, and very, very wealthy people like Mitt Romney.
Right, exactly. And that results in taxpayer subsidies to major corporations, lack of enforcement of antitrust laws, and others which across the board are going to work to the advantage of major corporations and to the disadvantage of smaller independent businesses that we represent.
There you go. Jeff Melchin, the co-founder of the American Independent Business Alliance, AMIBA.net. And if you run a small business, be sure to check it out. But also, I mean, it's a lot of great information there. Montana versus the U.S. Supreme Court. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you, Tom.
Great to have you back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more on Occupy Congress. And $374,000 is not all that much. Say what? Here's a clip that I find particularly amazing. Jacob discovered this, and it's just his comment to me was, you know, when Jerry Springer is the rational guy in the room, and, you know, I used to work with Jerry Springer back when I was on Air America Radio. He had a show there briefly, and he actually is a fairly rational guy. He's been a decent progressive Democrat for a long time, but most people think of him as this kind of crazy showbiz guy, you know, who has you know, people who like to hit each other over the heads on his TV show. And he was on GOP TV, you know, what Roger Ailes called it when he suggested it to Richard Nixon. Nixon didn't have the money to fund it, but Rupert Murdoch did, and so it's called Fox TV now. But anyhow, he was on Fox, and this is what Jerry Springer had to say, how they pushed back on him and how he pushed back on them. When Jerry Springer sounds like the rational guy in the room, it's amazing. Here.
We're here on Fox News. Every single day, in fairness, you guys, every single day, bash President Obama.
I'm going to take you to task on that. I'm going to take you to task on that, because on this panel right here,
exactly,
we have a fair and balanced panel right here.
Exactly.
And I'm the independent.
What's the rest of the show? The rest of the show, every single morning, you guys are slamming Obama. You know you are.
Yeah. And that's why, you know, I don't object to Fox News existing, or any other, you know, show with an edge. I'm doing one, but to call it news, I don't pretend that this program is news. This program is commentary. Fox should take the word news out of their name. They should call it Fox Opinion or GOP TV. Actually, I think GOP TV is what it should be called. But anyway, back to all of the other issues that we're on here. Dale in Dayton, Ohio. Hey, Dale, what's on your mind today?
Well, I'm a person that's been both in the private sector and the government sector. I was in the military for over 20 years. I've also been pretty high up in the corporate ladder.
Okay.
And I think the big problem with the corporations and the government is the corporations are trying to keep anyone out of politics that's a common man because they have common sense.
I think that it's just that you've got large corporations that have become predators, and they've become so large that they push governments around. The 50 largest countries in the world by GDP are actually corporations, or 50 out of the 100 largest.
Well, that's true.
So you know, they basically they take over. But excellent point, Dale. Thank you for calling and making it. They're pushing government around, and they're pushing America around. Stephen in Chicago. Hey, Stephen, what's up?
Oh, I've got a plan that could change the whole face of the world economy and the environment.
Okay.
It's the way you value stocks and companies.
Mm-hmm.
To just say that the value of a company is what they earn is totally ridiculous and irrelevant. A company is worth what it is worth to the value of the world economy. So if a company is paying slave wages and they're destroying the environment, someone has to fix that.
Yeah, so we need a new metric, in other words, rather than just saying a company is worth seven times earnings.
You can't say that what they earn is what the company is actually worth to the world economy. Someone has to repair that. There's people that cannot buy goods and help the world economy.
Mm-hmm.
And if the value of a company was based on its value to the world economy, they would be forced to do what's right. If you pay better wages, of course, more people can go out and buy things, and that's going to stimulate the world economy. That's going to make the world economy better.
Right. That I got it, Stephen. In fact, this is the argument that I keep making, that you and I, and thank you very much for the call, that you and I as consumers are the job creators, because we're buying things that make that cause other people to say, hey, I better make some more of that. I better hire somebody to do it. Don, Pittsburgh, Kansas. Hey, Don, what's on your mind today?
Hello.
Hey, Don. What's up?
Well, I just wanted to say that I think the timing of the PIPA and SOPA acts and the Defense Authorization Police State Act are not, for one thing, they're coordinated, and for another thing, it's not incidental. The ruling class is worried. They see signs of resistance, and they know that conditions are going to get much worse in the United States over the next, year, 2 years,
whatever. 3 to 5 years, yeah.
Yeah, and they're getting ready to suppress dissent violently. They're going to arrest people in large numbers. They're going to do all these things, and of course...
They're already doing that.
What?
They're already doing that.
Haven't you seen
people pepper sprayed?
The FEMA camps, all this stuff that, who knows what exactly the truth is.
Well,
but they're ready.
Yeah, the FEMA camp story has been widely debunked, but there's plenty of jail cells in the United States.
And there's plenty of abandoned military facilities that could easily be used to take people out to.
Yeah.
I mean, talking about a ruling class that's killed 30 million people in the world in the last 40 years. They're ruthless and they're deadly.
How are you suggesting that they've killed so many people? By virtue of the wars that they have for the profits?
3 million people were killed in Southeast Asia. 1 million people were killed in Indonesia. Two or 3 million people were killed in Iraq. I'm saying directly and indirectly, but in both in the military actions in Iraq and the, the various sanctions and everything that are said by many people to have killed 1 million people before the wars even began.
Yep. No, I cannot disagree with you.
And you go on and add these things up, the famines, the murders, the, Patrice Lumumba. You go on and on and on. Many, many people have been killed. So only 20 million. I mean, maybe I'm exaggerating.
No, I get your point, and I think it's well said, and I agree with it. I'm not sure that there is, like, this kind of ruling class conspiracy to create a giant military machine that's going to take us out, but it certainly is convenient. And if you look at what's going on and the way that our police are being militarized, I think it's a very, very, very unhealthy trend for the United States.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So is SOPA and our SOPA and PIPA, and we're doing our show in a darkened studio today in solidarity, are they symptoms of a coming police state?
Thank God for the Supreme Court, Protestant high-minded sort, never would rule us from the bench, hit us with a monkey wrench, except when it comes to appointing a president for a democratic nation. We're handing elections over now to monster corporations.
There you go. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you on the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. Assuming that what we're hearing is right, by the way, that the Obama administration is saying no to the Keystone XL pipeline, or at least no for now, that they're not going to allow the Republicans in Congress who are owned by big oil, and some Democrats in Congress who are owned by big oil, that this administration is not going to allow them to be basically backed into a corner and give in to running a pipeline across the center of the United States all the way down to Texas so that oil from Canada can be exported to South America and Europe in particular, and principally, and also to Asia through the Panama Canal, that they're not going to allow this to happen. This is the kind of thing that would not have happened if people had not shown up. You know, if Bill McKibben and all the people and Medea Benjamin and all the people who were with him who showed up at the White House and got arrested there, Chris Hedges was among them. If they had not gotten arrested at the White House, if we had not been covering this on our program over and over and over again and on our TV program at night and other programs had not been covering this, if there was no progressive media, if there were no progressive movements, if MoveOn.org hadn't spoken out, if it wasn't being covered on all the various progressive websites, if there had not been a grassroots movement to say to President Obama, please say no to the XL pipeline, they'd be building the thing right now. This is a demonstration of how if you get active, you can see some positive action or at least movement in the right direction. So again, people think, oh, we've got to have a president who's perfect, or we have a president who's an absolute devil or whatever. You know, Bush was evil, Obama's a saint. Oh, no, neither one is true. I mean, Bush did some awful things. Obama's done some pretty good things, I think. But, you know, he's also done a few things that I have some problems with. But the bottom line is that the presidents get out in front of the march. They get out in front of the parade. It's not just president. I mean, this is true of all elected officials. This is why you're seeing so many members of Congress say, you know, this SOPA thing, this PIPA thing, I don't think so. I don't want to be picked on by Google or by the people. Actually, the word leader does not appear in our Constitution. This nation, our constitutionally limited representative democratic republic, is a nation of, by, and for the people, to paraphrase Abraham Lincoln. We the people, to quote from the first three words of the Constitution. But it only works that way when we, the people, get out there, get involved, and get engaged. And, you know, we need to be doing that more and more and more. Richard and Eugene. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good. What's on your mind?
I just want to say, first off, that you rock. You're a tremendous help to our society, and thank you for spreading the truth.
Well, thank you. The kind words are appreciated, but they're absolutely not necessary. And they cut into the time of what you were going to say. What's on your mind?
Well, I was watching Good Morning America this morning, unfortunately, and they were talking about SOPA and PIPA, and they basically just laughed it off, saying that it's going to inconvenience a few teenagers from getting inappropriate information.
Right.
So that's our corporate media at work, basically downplaying this whole situation.
And you know, the fact of the matter is it will inconvenience a few teenagers, but it's also going to put a giant governmental foot into the internet. And what astounds me is there's so many Republicans, you know, in favor of this. Frankly, what astounds me is that there's Democrats in favor of this. You know, Patrick Leahy, who's the head of the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, and a good Democrat from Vermont, is one of the co-sponsors of the PIPA version in the Senate. And that kind of
blew me away too.
Yeah, and Daryl Issa, who, you know, is the only member of to the best of my knowledge, the only member of Congress who's actually in his past was a criminal. Daryl Issa is the Republican wackadoodle from California, is actually coming out against these things because he says this is too much big government. Now, you know, the reality is that there are giant corporations on both sides of this issue. You've got you know, kind of like Sony and the big TV networks and the big producers of content and whatnot on the side of SOPA and PIPA. I don't know specifically about Sony. I shouldn't name an individual company because I don't have a list. But the big producers, they're saying, hey, let's lock this stuff down. But on the other hand, you've got the big companies, you know, like Google, who make a living linking out to the internet and aggregating information, and they don't want to have to go through and YouTube and whatnot. They don't want to have to go through every single thing that they've got and say, is this a violation? Might this be a violation? Is this linked to a violation? Does this link to something that links to a violation? You know, they don't want to do that. And so it's kind of like, you know, the elephants are fighting and the people are getting squashed. But the reality is that at least the elephants who are, you know, the Google elephants, I think are on more on the right side than the content providers. Interesting point, Richard, about how it was handled by the news. Thank you for sharing that with us. Armin in Bradenton. Hey, Armin, what's on your mind today?
Quickly, there's a story on whatreallyhappened.com that 94% of all the revenue that the IRS has taken in right now is already being earmarked for the Pentagon and war spending. And on the Young Turks last night, they were talking that an individual in the United States that makes over $35,000 pays 25% in taxes, and the majority of the wealthy Republicans and Democrats, including Obama, only pay 15%. So you tell me, Tom Hartman, who are the Democrats, that being said, sticking for the welfare bill?
Well, I think I think you're mixing apples and oranges. The fact of the matter is that Democrats like Jan Schakowsky, the Progressive Caucus, Jan Schakowsky has proposed a very progressive tax system that would increase the taxes on the millionaires and would decrease in taxes the taxes on working people. And, you know, it's something that, frankly, in my opinion, needs to be done. It absolutely needs to be done. You will not find a single Republican who will support that. They want to do like, you know, Ron Paul, take the taxes on rich people to zero. Take the taxes on corporations to zero. And it just, it to me, it seems nuts. I don't know how else to say it. Robert in Orange County, California, listening on KTLK. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Yeah, hey, Tom, how you doing?
Fine, what's up?
You know, you were just bringing up the fact that not one Republican would support what is, in fact, a really good thing for the country.
Well,
and I just
you're talking
to say,
about taxation, these, yeah.
I'm talking about taxation. Look, what differentiated Huntsman from all the rest of the Republicans was that he put the country first and became a Chinese or our diplomat to China. And because of that, he was a pariah in the Republican Party, even though all of his positions were in lockstep with all that ludicrous.
Right.
Crap.
He was as right wing as any of those other Republicans. In fact, he was to the right of some of the Republicans on the stage. And although he was always portrayed as the moderate because he was kind of a soft-spoken guy. But I think the big story about John Huntsman that nobody tells is the fact that the unaffiliated PAC that made his candidacy possible and allowed him to get into and stay in the race was funded by his billionaire father.
Right. But bottom line is, go ahead.
Well, it's just, you know, I find that amazing. It's just like, you know, the unaffiliated Romney PAC is run by old Romney business partners and friends. The unaffiliated Gingrich PAC is run by, you know, former Gingrich cronies. It's like these, you know, this is what Stephen Colbert is making fun of, where he created his super PAC and now he's handed it off to Jon Stewart to say, oh, I have no involvement with that. You know, it's like to his mentor, you know, the guy who built his career. It's just,
right.
It's absolutely bizarre. It's absolutely bizarre. Thanks a lot, Robert, for the call. An excellent point. Virginia in Portland. Hey, Virginia, thanks for listening to KPOJ. What's up?
Oh, Tom, we miss you in Portland.
Well, I get back occasionally. And I'm on the air there, so every day.
I know. Hey, listen, I keep trying to comprehend and condense what I'm seeing and taking in of the in this theater of the absurd, and here's my take.
Mm-hmm.
A game of marbles is always over when one player has all the marbles.
Yes.
And this is the folly of unfettered capitalism.
Yes.
Never surrender your shooter.
Yeah, this yeah, spoken like a good marbles player. This is exactly what Karl Marx pointed out in Das Kapital. His analysis of capitalism and unfettered, unrestrained laissez-faire capitalism was spot on, that ultimately you would end up with, it would become like a monopoly game. In fact, the monopoly game was introduced in the 1920s as a way of demonstrating to people the dangers of monopoly. And it would become like a monopoly game, and you would end up with a very small number of very, very large, wealthy, powerful corporations owning virtually every industry and having so much power that they could control the government. His prescription didn't work out so well, but his analysis was right. And the way to get, you know, halfway in between his analysis and his prescription is to have what Franklin Roosevelt had and what we in the United States had, you know, up until Ronald Reagan came along, which is regulated capitalism and the enforcement of the Sherman Antitrust Act and, you know, prevent companies from getting so large that they're so toxic that they destroy the system within their work, which they're working. They've become parasites within the system. Virginia, thank you so much for the call, and thanks for listening to KPOJ. You know what I miss the most about Portland? I miss listening to Carl Wolfson every morning. We'll be back 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And we will check in with Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service in just a moment. Find out what's going on here in Washington, D.C. today.
Blackbird, fly. Blackbird, fly. Into the line of a dark black night.
Yep, the internet going black today in protest of SOPA and PIPA, the laws that would criminalize basically linking out to, even linking to a website that might have pirated content on it. Or variations on that. Just a quick FYI, by the way, Bill McKibben will be here at the end of the next hour with his take on the president saying no to the Keystone Pipeline, at least for the moment. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us, brought to you by Self-Empowerment, the new book by Ellen Ratner and Ann Gaiman. Victoria, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Thanks very much. Yes, and that is the lead, in fact. This afternoon, the Obama administration will reject the Keystone XL pipeline, probably around 3 o'clock. What they will say is that although the permit will be rejected, TransCanada will be allowed to continue to work on and pitch an alternative route through Nebraska.
Hmm.
But so the timing will be interesting because, you know, how long will it take you to work on and pitch an alternative route? Then if you pitch an alternative route, will all the paperwork and everything be possible for it to happen before the election?
Right. And the answer, of course, is no.
Very unlikely.
Or at least the answer that the administration is hoping is no. And
I would think so.
And then the question is, once he's a lame duck president, will he do what's right or will he cave into the oil companies? I mean, we already have an oil pipeline. Go ahead.
I was going to say I don't know the answer to that.
Well, none of us do, and it's the question I think of the day. But step by step. So anyhow, what else is going on?
Well, the other piece of this is also the feeling was that he wanted to get ahead of this. He has until February the 21st. The feeling was he wanted to get ahead of this before the State of the Union next week, so that it's out there, so that if he does address it, he addresses it as a decision that has already been made, so that he can put his vision out there, right, and that he doesn't have this hanging over him, so that it's done.
Well, that makes political sense.
Yeah, it makes political sense. Well, obviously, you've been talking about SOPA and PIPA, which, of course, we have been talking about all day. The political aspects of it is the Senate is set to wade in next Tuesday still, with a vote just before the State of the Union on whether to even begin formal debate on the piracy bill. Judiciary Committee Chairman Pat Leahy thinks he's assembled this 60-vote majority, but it's really fallen apart. Politically imperiled Scott Brown, one of the Republicans on his list, as you know, signaled overnight that he's got cold feet. And with the way they're dropping like flies today,
mm-hmm,
I'd be amazed if he's got anything like the numbers that he needs.
We're doing our show from a dark studio today. We have all the lights off except one little lamp here next to me in solidarity with the web that has gone dark.
Very cool.
So, yeah.
The whole thing, I think the whole thing is fascinating and very cool. Meanwhile, over in the House, Judiciary Chairman Lamar Smith still says he's soldiering on. He plans to pick up next month where they left off in December on their version of the piracy bill. But he's going up against the forces of Daryl Issa, who's trying to water down the bill at the behest of the technology companies with whom he's very tight. And he says that House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, who sets the agenda, told him that it's not coming up for a vote. So it'll be interesting to see who really does set the agenda there.
Yeah, it will be. It very,
very
much will be.
Very interesting to see that.
We haven't heard from Speaker Boehner yet, have we?
No, he's been fairly quiet on this one.
Yeah, he's. I think he's. He's figured out that if he keeps his head down, it's the safest thing to do in all circumstances.
Yes.
What else is up?
He actually was meeting behind closed doors with the other 241 members of his House majority for the first time this year, coming off a defeat in the payroll tax cut fight as they head off tomorrow for their retreat in Baltimore. And they came out of the meeting proclaiming the conference is united around the belief that President Obama's policies have failed. And Speaker Boehner briefly addressed the anger that some of the members have voiced over the handling of the payroll tax cut bill and telling reporters after the meeting, listen, we've got a lot of disparate voices within our conference. We were picking the right fight, but I would argue we probably picked it at the wrong time.
Right.
Also, very interesting poll out today, a Rasmussen poll. And these polls tend to be kind of interesting when they skew Republican, because it is a Republican-type polling company. And this one is showing that Newt Gingrich has gained 11 points very quickly, jumping from 16% up to 27% of the vote, with Romney at 30%.
Well, that's very interesting.
Just in a very few days.
And today, I believe it was, his not associated with Newt, but run by friends and cronies of him, of his PAC, just released this 30-minute movie, When Mitt Romney Came to Town. Have you seen this thing, Victoria?
I haven't seen When Mitt Romney Came to Town, no.
It is astounding. It's astounding.
Really?
It makes him out like the Antichrist. And it shows, what it really demonstrates is the dark side of vulture fund capitalism.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So anyhow. That's
very interesting. Well, Romney has not gained. He stayed the same, and Gingrich has gained. And they've got one more debate. So Gingrich is gaining.
When is the next debate?
It's over the weekend, the CNN debate.
Okay, and the vote is over the weekend, isn't it?
Yes. So I think I think the CNN debate is just before the vote. It's very, very, very tightly scheduled, and I can't remember exactly when, but it's very tight.
Interesting. Okay. Thank you.
Meantime. House Oversight Committee, Daryl Issa again, Countrywide, the investigation of Countrywide, the number one American home loan lender.
Right.
Well, it turns out that not only people like Chris Dodd got loans, but now it turned out last week that NRCC, National Republican Committee Chairman Pete Sessions, Armed Services Chairman Buck McEwen, and fellow Californian Elton Gallagher also got sweetheart deals, as well as one Democrat, Ed Towns. So top Democrat is saying to ISA, so are you going to make this equal opportunity, hey?
And he's, of course, going to say no. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Up next, is capitalism racist? Stay tuned.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
From our darkened studio in solidarity with websites all over the world that have gone dark in opposition to SOPA and PIPA, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. A.W.R. Hawkins is on the line with us, regular contributor to Town Hall and Big Government, Pajamas Media, RedCountry.com, TownHall.com, AWRHawkins.com, his website. A.W.R., welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. This is you were writing about this, and Newt Gingrich and Juan Williams. Let me just very quickly play the clip, and then let's discuss it.
Speaker Gingrich, you recently said black Americans should demand jobs, not food stamps. You also said poor kids lack a strong work ethic and proposed having them work as janitors in their schools. Can't you see that this is viewed at a minimum as insulting to all Americans, but particularly to black Americans?
No, I don't see that.
And he got a standing ovation for that. To assert black Americans should demand jobs, not food stamps, is to assert that black Americans are demanding food stamps and not jobs, which is simply not the case. How does Newt Gingrich not get that, and how do you not get that?
Well, I believe that if you look at the entitlement mentality that Obama has pushed, that's what he's addressing. What
entitlement mentality are you talking about, and when did President Obama push it?
Well, I mean,
one example.
Well, I mean, the mentality we have where I believe 47% of households pay no income tax.
Federal income tax.
That's right.
And before the Bush crash, it was about 38%. And the reason why is because we're in the middle of the Bush Great Depression.
What you've seen is
after 30 years of Reaganomics, you know, when Reagan came into office, you had a much higher proportion of Americans paying federal income taxes. And now it takes two people in a household to maintain the same standard of living it did when Ronald Reagan came into office 30 years ago. We've, you know, 30 years of Reaganomics has wiped out the middle class, shipped our jobs overseas, and now you're going to blame those people and say that they have an entitlement mentality?
No one's blaming them. I haven't mentioned them. I said Obama. As you know, as I said, 47% of the people pay no federal income tax. We have the highest number of people on food stamps ever in history.
Because we have the Bush Depression.
Population. No, you can't keep blaming Bush. Bush has been gone for 3 years. Obama's the one who has spent $4 trillion plus.
Bush deregulated. I can't blame Bush. Bush ran up $5 trillion of debt in this country. He declared two wars that were off the books. He put a program into Medicare, a poison pill into Medicare that was not paid for. Obama put that stuff back on the budget. That certainly makes the budget look worse. I'll give you that. But this and then by deregulating the banks and letting them. And in fact, when Eliot Spitzer, when he was the attorney general for the state of New York, tried to enforce a law to stop Wall Street from ripping people off. George W. Bush's administration pulled out an 1856 maritime law to say, sorry, states can't regulate the banks in which they operate. This absolutely is George Bush's fault. It's a disaster brought about by George Bush that President Obama inherited. And we've had 14 straight months of private sector job growth as a result of Obama's policies, whereas when Bush left office, we were losing 700,000 jobs a month.
Well, is the private sector job growth you talk about, is that what's given us the 8.7% unemployment rate right now?
That's why it's that, not 10%. Yeah, which is the direction it was heading. If we kept going, if we had gone for 3 years at the exact same rate of job loss that we were having, that we had when George Bush left office, our unemployment rate right now would be nearly 20%.
Well, in reality, as you know, it is 11 to 12% if you count the number of people who are no longer even seeking work because they're living off food stamps. And that's not just black Americans. It's not just white Americans. It's all Americans that Obama has been able to persuade to live off the government dole.
Give me an example of, please, one thing that President Obama did or said to persuade people to live off the government dole. Just one example.
No, it's just his entire mentality.
No, one example, please.
Anyone who watches it knows it.
One example, please.
Well, I mean, I don't have a precise thing to tell you. I can't name.
Okay, so you're just making this stuff up.
No, I'm not making things up.
You're just quoting Sean Hannity.
No, I'm not quoting Sean Hannity.
One example, please. Of food stamp mentality coming out of that black man in the White House that I realize a lot of people think, holy cow, how can that be?
Well, I never talked about what color he is.
Well, but see, Newt implicitly is. When he says black Americans should demand jobs, not food stamps, they are demanding jobs, not food stamps. And what he is saying, and by saying that, is that they are demanding food stamps and not jobs. And you're backing that up, saying that President Obama is encouraging that, and yet you can't provide a single example of it.
Well, Do you think Occupy Wall Street wanted jobs and not handouts?
Well, because first of all, that has nothing to do with whether or not Newt Gingrich is a racist and whether this is a racist statement. But
it has everything to do with it because Occupy Wall Street was fighting the man.
Do you think Obama
lined up with them and said he understood their frustration?
So you think that the banksters like Mitt Romney, who pays a maximum 15% income tax because we have two tax systems, two income taxes in the United States. We have the ordinary income tax, for people who earn ordinary income, and we have the capitalist gains tax for capitalists who make their money with money. And that's why Mitt Romney, even though he makes millions of dollars a year, pays a maximum of 15% income tax, whereas you or I or pretty much any other person who's working, oh, I shouldn't say you, I don't know, maybe you are a capitalist, but most working people, not the other 99%, pay up to 36%. You're in favor of maintaining that system like that?
Well, number one, I'm not a Romney man, and I didn't call to talk about Romney.
Well, I hope there's not a Republican in the House or the Senate who doesn't want to keep that 15% capitalist gains tax in place.
Well, I'm not talking about that. And, you know, I don't divide things into 1% and 99%. I don't like Romney for a myriad of reasons. It has nothing to do with his income or how much he pays in taxes. So that's not what I called to talk about.
Okay. Well, what you called to talk about was whether or not this was a racist state, whether capital. Actually, the article that you wrote, we're talking with awrhawkins.com is his website, is Newt to Juan Williams, Capitalism is Not Racist. I don't recall the word capitalism ever having popped up in any of those questions. Did I miss something?
No. Capitalism is the idea, though, that you get a job and you make your own way. You don't let
the government
make a way for you. Yes, it is.
AWR, respectfully, please read a dictionary. Capitalism is making money with capital. There are probably fewer than 100,000 capitalists, maybe 300,000 capitalists in the United States, people who earn their living by investing. Everybody else is working, is a worker. And workers are not capitalists. Capitalists are people who earn their living with capital. That's why we have a special tax rate for them called the capitalist gains tax.
No, well, you're
Mitt Romney is a capitalist. He's come right out and said, I've been unemployed for the last 10 years. Now, he does make $370,000 in speaking fees a year, so I'd say he's not unemployed. But he does make millions from capital. That's capitalism. But
well,
you and I getting paid for a job we do, that's not capitalism.
You're using it in a strict sense. But in a connotative sense, the common sense that we all use it in, capitalism speaks to the free market that we're supposed to have.
There's no free market.
And that covers everybody. And I believe the market's overregulated, so I don't believe it is free. That's probably one point you and I would agree on.
Do you think the football games would work better if there were no referees and either team, whichever team had the most money, could move the goalposts?
I don't believe football and economics have that much in common.
How is establishing the rules for football any different than establishing the rules for a marketplace?
The marketplace is driven by the desires of the people, period. That's all that should drive it.
So we the people, get to set the rules by which the marketplace operates. We do that through our government by passing laws saying this is fraud and this is not, right?
Not particularly. The marketplace is driven by my desire. I pay for what I want. I don't pay for what I want. That drives the marketplace.
So it's the consumers.
That's right.
So the consumers are the job creators, not the rich people.
There's a complementary factor because the wealthy bring in the capital that the consumers don't have, but that capital is ultimately driven by the desire of the consumer.
Okay, AWR Hawkins, you got the last word. AWRHawkins.com. Check it out.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back. More on, is capitalism racist? Is it inherently racist? And the other news of the day, SOPA, IPIP.
The dream of the 90s is alive in Portland.
Portland, you can go to like a record store and sell your CDs.
The dream of the 90s is alive in Portland.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here, and Carrie Coe is with us with OccupyTheEGT.org. Carrie is a participant in Occupy Portland. Carrie, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, I should say she. First of all, we're by Portland. We're talking about Portland, Oregon, not Portland, Maine. And describe for our viewers and listeners what the EGT is.
So, what's happening is that a small community in Washington that's near Portland called Longview has put out a call to action have occupies and all people from the 99% mobilize to stop a grain ship that's coming into port in Longview. This grain ship is docking with EGT. They own the dock there and the terminal, and their parent company, Bungie Limited, are the two companies that we're really talking about. EGT is currently in a labor struggle with the local workers in Longview. They have been doing union busting activities. They've been driving down the wages in that small community. And their parent company, Bungie Limited, who will ultimately own the grain that's at that terminal, has a long history of being a corporate leader in the race to the bottom. They have been using slave labor in South America to grow soybeans. They have been polluting our air and violating the Clean Air Act. And they have been have got a fine last year for manipulating the grain market here in the U.S. So we in Occupy Portland have formed this Occupy the EGT Action Committee, and we are working with Occupies up and down the West Coast to mobilize, to go up and show support and solidarity with our fellow workers and community members in Longview, Washington.
Great. And so how can, you know, I think the, you know, what the call to action here for the, our listeners and who are, for example, listening on KPOJ in Portland or in Oregon or Washington, who might be catching us on Sirius or XM or Free Speech TV or Dish Network or DirecTV, whatever, is fairly obvious. But for people in the rest of the country, what's the message? Is it that, is there a specific call to action that OccupyTheEGT.org has for others, or are you rather showing that the Occupy movement has gone beyond just, hey, we're going to occupy a park and make a statement, into direct action in support of working Americans? Or is it both?
Well, both. Yeah, definitely both. I think that the Occupy movement is broader than just the park. We definitely are talking about real issues for working Americans and real issues for workers around the world who are experiencing exploitation through these companies. The call to action, though, for people who are unable to make the drive up to Longview is that is twofold. One, Bungie Limited actually is a giant global company and has offices, has grain facilities and soybean facilities all over this country, and on Occupy the EGT, you can find, or you will be able to find, where your local sort of Bungie outlet is. And definitely we're asking for folks to do an action there. The other action we're asking is that the U.S. government has said that this ship that's coming up to Longview will actually get an escort from the U.S. military. The U.S. Coast Guard will be guarding this ship as it goes up the rivers towards the port, which is the first time in 40 years that the U.S. military has intervened on behalf of management in a labor dispute. And labor unions and working people around the country are taking that extremely seriously.
Wow.
So one option that folks have is to do an action at your local Coast Guard office, too.
Okay. And plus, I'm guessing that the cost of having the Coast Guard guard that ship or take the side of management, to use your descriptor, is being paid not by EGT or Bungie, but by you and me in our tax dollars.
I would imagine that that's true.
Okay. I guess we don't know that with certainty, but typically that's the case.
Sure,
I mean,
but we would imagine.
You know, ExxonMobil, parts of their millions and billions in profits, hundreds of millions and billions in profits, comes from the fact that our military, keeps oil lanes going and things like that. It's the same kind of thing. Carrie Koth, OccupyTheEGT.org, and a participant, of course, in Occupy Portland. Thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. You did a marvelous job of just laying the issue out and making it real for people. I think it's so, so important to do. Corky in Rochester, New York. Hey, Corky, what's on your mind today?
Tom, you're going to really disappoint me if you tell me you didn't really believe Romney paid 15%.
No, I've been saying for a long time, my guess is 14%. Because I figured he would...
How much is offshore that he didn't pay taxes on?
Well, we know...
And this is the whole thing about all the companies and all the tax money. If you took all that tax money offshore and taxed it, there'd be enough money to give everybody universal top care health, pay for all the social networks, and pay down the debt. And we all know that.
Yep. I'm solidly with you, and I have been saying that for some time on this program. And we learned today that Bain actually set up, and thank you, Corky, for the call, Bain actually set up checking accounts offshore in tax havens like the Cayman Islands, and, you know, presumably for their investors who want to hide their taxes. I mean, what other possible reason would they do that? And I can't think of one. Courtney in Los Angeles. Hey, Courtney, what's on your mind today? We got about a minute to the break, by the way.
Hi. First, I want to tell you, I first learned about you from Jesus Camp, and I think you're just a remarkable person.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much. The question that I have for you, because I really value your opinion, is that the SOPA and the PIPA Act that are coming through, you can see that there's just a large mass of collective voices, people really feeling and calling to action.
Mm-hmm.
What I don't understand is how the Defense Act went through so easily. It just sort of slipped in. I don't understand how people didn't get as inflamed by realizing that they were losing their due process rights and eventually even coming into a militant state.
Sure. The reason why is because the SOPA and PIPA Act are not just being opposed by people like you and me and civil libertarians. They're also being opposed by several large corporations whose profits would be hurt by them, like Google. And because there's large organizations like Wikipedia who have a massive presence. And so because these large organizations will be hurt, they are amplifying the voice of civil libertarians. There was no large organization that was going to be hurt by the military-industrial complex getting richer, and that's why there wasn't a blowback there, in my opinion. I hope it doesn't sound too cynical.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
You know, I said I hope it doesn't sound too cynical. It is cynical. It's tragically, it's the way things are, and it's why we need to change them. That music means it's time for the good, the bad, and the very, very trichotillomaniacally ugly. The good. Suffolk County, New York officials. Last week, Suffolk County, New York officials gave local student Samantha Garvey and her family a new home. Garvey is not just a student, she's a prodigy, and recently was named a semifinalist in a prestigious national science contest. She is also homeless. And her family lost their house as a result of the economic crisis and the Great Bush Recession. Her story of excelling in academics despite living in a homeless shelter has garnered international attention, and she was invited by President Obama to attend the State of the Union address. It's refreshing to see that in a society today marked by political positioning and constant disagreement, some of those in government can still come together and agree to do the right thing. The bad. Pennsylvania Republican Governor Tom Corbett. Since last August, Governor Corbett's Department of Welfare has removed over 88,000 children from the Medicaid rolls in an effort to, quote, reduce waste, fraud, and abuse, end quote. Sadly, the majority of the children's families cannot afford legal help to regain their Medicaid status, and many of them may not even know they've lost their benefits. But Corbett's state needs the money. After all, how else can it afford to give fracking companies a fracking tax break? Pollution and oil and gas profits over the lives of children? That's how Governor Corbett rolls. And the very, very ugly, Reverend Jesse Lee Peterson. Reverend Peterson, a super conservative African-American Republican who has campaigned against the likes of the Reverend Jesse Jackson and President Obama, told the Huffington Post that he would, quote, take all the black people to the South and put them on the plantation so that they would understand the ethic of working, end quote. And went on to say, quote, I'm going to put them all on the plantation. They need a good, hard education on what it is to work, end of quote. These remarks came just a day after Newt Gingrich seemed to suggest in the South Carolina primary that African-Americans do not have a work ethic. It seems the Reverend is unaware of the real problems that African-Americans face, like unequal access to education and discrimination in the workforce. Suggesting that we should reestablish a system of slavery to teach a lesson rather than work to solve the real problems that African Americans face? That's just very, very, very ugly. Amazing. A lot we've covered today. Back to SOPA and patents and those kinds of things. Jeff in Tampa, Florida, you have some thoughts on that. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hi there. I just had a story, and sorry ahead of time, it's a bit of a downer, but just a story about my father who actually, I believe he had over 25 patents to his name by the time his career was over, but every single one of them was the property of the company that he worked for. He never saw more than just a pittance for them.
Yeah, that's normal just these days.
Yeah, this was a patent for the inflator in an airbag that was pretty much in every car that was on the road and made in this country, I'd say for a good, 10, 12, 15 years.
Yeah.
And
never saw a dime, but made millions for the company he worked for. Yeah. Those rights stayed with them. That company was, of course, bought out and disassembled by the Carlyle Group.
Oh, really? The Carlyle Group. Yeah, which is the larger version of Bain Capital. Yeah. Amazing. Amazing. Well, thanks, Jeff, for sharing that story. It's all too true. In America, the people who own the copyrights and the patent, the rights are very often not people. They're people according to the Supreme Court, according to Mitt Romney, but they're actually corporations. And, that ain't a good thing. Jason in Washington, D.C. Hey, Jason, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Great. What's up?
Hey, I had a quick question for you. Do you think Europe's bankrupt?
Define bankrupt.
Well, in terms of their debt to GDP levels.
No. No, not even close. Japan's debt to GDP level is 220%, 2.2 something to 1, and they're not bankrupt.
Right.
No, I don't think so at all.
So you think a country can go on at high rates of debt for long periods of time?
It certainly has happened. It depends on who owns the debt. In the case of Japan, over 95% of their debt is owned by individual Japanese citizens. So that debt basically is just a good investment. In fact, it's one of the more common ways the Japanese save is they buy government bonds rather than putting their money in a bank. And in that case, then the profit beneficiary of the savings are the Japanese people and the Japanese government rather than big transnational banks. So it actually works to their benefit in Japan to have a system like that. Now, it is possible for you and I to buy treasuries directly from the Treasury Department. There's a program called Treasury Direct, but there's an absolute limit. I think it's either $10,000 or $20,000 that you can buy. To basically discourage Americans from doing that and keep it all in the hands of Wall Street. So if you want to buy treasuries, you got to go, for example, buy TLT on the New York Stock Exchange, which is an exchange-traded fund in treasuries, but you've got a for-profit Wall Street corporation in the middle skimming money off the top. But what's the point you're trying to make?
My question is, my thought process is, if Europe is doing such high taxation and they've got this great, cradle-to-grave type of thing, how did they end up in so much debt?
Well, most of Europe isn't...
The taxation policies were going to cover all that, but now it looks like the Greeks and the Italians and everybody,
Well, the problem with your statement, Jason, is the "and everybody." The Greeks and the Italians got taken down by Goldman Sachs and a couple of other banksters. And Matt Taibbi has done brilliant reporting on this over at the Rolling Stone. You won't find it on the right-wing websites, but it's solid. It's absolutely solid. And these countries were taken down by the banksters. And on top of that, you've got a worldwide recession. In Greece, you've got another problem, and that is that in Greece, the very, very wealthy people in Greece have gamed the system to the point where basically they don't pay any taxes at all. Here, at least Mitt Romney's paying 15%. In Greece, he would be paying 2%. And so, they've got that problem. But most of the countries in Europe are not in debt. Most of the countries in Europe are doing just fine, thank you very much. So, to say, Greece and Spain and all the rest, no, there's not all the rest. It's basically right now Greece, Italy, and Spain and arguably Ireland, because Ireland is suffering so badly from the recession that they've shifted from most people being employed and paying money into the government to many people being unemployed and getting benefits from the government. That's the reason why you have those systems is so that when you have these periodic recessions – that are part of the business cycle, that you don't end up with people starving to death, that you don't end up with people devastated like they are here in the United States. You don't end up with people homeless. I mean, I was just in Sweden, and I didn't see and Iceland, and and Iceland, you could say, is arguably horribly in debt right now because they privatized their banks and then their banksters robbed them blind. But the fact of the matter is that we didn't see a single homeless person in Iceland. That the taxi driver and the waiter in the restaurant would not allow me to tip them because everybody's paid a decent salary in Iceland. In Sweden, I didn't see a homeless person anywhere in either of those two countries. I saw one arguably schizophrenic person in Sweden who looked like maybe a street person, but clearly was mentally ill. But that was it. And
countries actually, the idea is that you pay for the downtime with some sort of a slush fund, rainy day fund, but it seems like every government that's out there never builds up a rainy day fund unless there's some company, a country that's benefiting from oil revenue.
Well, Well, like some of them have had it, or the alternative is you do what the United States did in 1944 or 1941. And when we entered World War II, we had a very small debt. It was historically about the same level of debt to GDP that we'd had since the George Washington administration. There's never been a time. I think there's been a couple of years back in the 1830s when we had no national debt. But basically, having a national debt has always been a good thing because there's people who want to buy that debt to invest. They want to, you know, they view it as a safe haven investment. And what we did was we borrowed so much money to fight World War II that by the time Eisenhower came into office, our debt to GDP ratio was 126. It was 126% of GDP. Now, we paid off that debt during the Eisenhower administration, not by cutting anything, not by any Republican plans, modern day Republican plans. We did it with the Republican plan back then, which Dwight Eisenhower promoted, which was the GI Bill, which was send every soldier, every person who'd been in World War II, which was probably 80 or 90% of all the men in the United States who were between 18 and 25 or 30 years old, send any of them to college for free, give them a stipend of a couple $100 a month to so that they can live while they're going to college. My dad did this. Louise's, my wife's dad, did this and all the way up to his law degree on the GI Bill and ended up being the assistant attorney general for the state of Michigan, the first person in his family to ever go to college. He did this with this. He did this. Eisenhower did this with backing up the loans, the home loans of veterans, so that they could. My dad's mortgage was 2.5%.
Was on those bonds. Tom, do you know what the rate of return on those government bonds were, though? If you gave the government a dollar after inflation,
back in the 40s, you're talking about.
Yes, if I bought those in 1946, do you know the inflation rate was 18.1%? So all these people that bought these bonds, they were actually like, if you want to look at it from the country's perspective, it was great for the government. But as an individual investor buying those war bonds, you got like about 18 or 19 cents back on the dollar.
Yeah, arguably. The same would be true if you'd bought GM bonds. The same would be true if you'd bought any
World War II.
The same would be true if you had put money in the bank. You know, the same would be true of anything that you did that was coming back at a fixed return. You're right. Inflation is a tax, or does erode the value of investments. But beyond that, we're not a business. We're a country. We got out of that debt by acting like a country, and that's the thing that you guys fundamentally miss, Jason.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Oh, let's run America like a family or like a business. No, I'm sorry, it's neither. It's a country.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy.
Welcome back to the program where we ask, is Walmart a person? And we say, no, I don't think so. Not a chance. No way. Don't even consider it. Bill McKibben on the line with us, the founder of 350.org, the environmentalist, author of Earth with two A's, and one of the smartest guys I know, one of my personal heroes, Bill McKibben. Welcome back to the program.
Back at you, brother. Good to be talking to you.
Thanks so much for being with us. So the president is announcing basically that he's saying no to the Republicans or to the oil industry that is saying we want a yes immediately on the pipeline. Tell us what you know about this and what you think this means.
Well, I'm still going off rumors because they haven't made an announcement yet, but it seems pretty likely that that's just as you said is what's going to happen. And if it does, I'd say there's two things to bear in mind here. One is it's a big victory for people who stood up. 8 months ago, no one really even knew about this Keystone Pipeline. As late as October, National Journal polled 300 of their, quote, energy insiders, unquote, in Washington, and 91% of them said that this pipeline would be approved. So the conventional wisdom was 91% wrong, and it was wrong precisely because people were willing to go to jail, go to public meetings and give testimony, make a record number of public comments, surround the White House, do all the things necessary to highlight the craziness of opening up Canada's tar sands to even more exploitation. This is one of those rare days in the 23 years that I've been working on climate change since I wrote the first book about it back in 1989. This is one of those rare days when scientists get to smile and big oil has to scowl for a few hours. It's quite a testament to the power of people when they shake off their cynicism and rise up.
Yeah.
The second thing, just I feel the need to say, since, you know, I'm no inveterate all the time knee-jerk fan of the president. I went out and got arrested outside his house. But today, he didn't just make the right decision, he made a really brave decision. Last week, the head of the American Petroleum Institute said if he didn't approve the permit, there would be huge political consequences. Well, he's got the money to make good on his threat. And so this was not the, you know, I always meet you halfway, Barack Obama, that people like to knock about a little bit. If the knock on Obama is that he's too conciliatory, not today. He stood up big.
Doesn't this mean that we always have to be the parade that the politicians get out in front of, and that without the parade, we can't rely on them to do the things that the people want, because A, they don't know, and B, they don't have the political power, which actually comes from us?
I think that that's absolutely right. So, you know, it's been an interesting year.
Bill, a question.
Civil disobedience, and it went straight into Occupy, and, you know, there's a lot of ferment out there, and we've got to make it count.
Yeah, amen. A caller called and asked the question, why, I mean, we already have a Keystone pipeline, which brings tar sand oil from Canada.
Yes, a small one, yes.
Down into Missouri, I believe, and then across over to Indiana, where it's refined into gasoline and other things. So, you know, to a certain extent, we're already refining Canadian tar sand oil. But beyond that, if it's such a big deal to have gasoline, which is whatever, you know, ultimately the way that this is pitched, you know, hey, it's going to lower gas prices because there's going to be more supply. Why not just refine it in Alberta and buy the refined product and let the Canadians make the profit on the refining? Or if it's a transnational corporation, if it's ExxonMobil, let them build a refinery in Alberta. Is it that the Canadians don't want to have a cancer alley in Canada the way that we do in Texas, Louisiana?
No, I don't think it's that, because the mining of the tar sands has built a environmental disaster pretty much unequaled any place on the face of the planet. All you have to do is go look at Google Earth to get a shot of what it looks like.
Okay.
I think it's more just that whether they're sending out crude or whether they're sending out gasoline, they still need a pipeline to get it out, because Alberta's in the middle of nowhere. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're trying to send it south to the Gulf of Mexico through Keystone, and they're trying to send it west across the Rockies into British Columbia for transport to Asia.
Right.
But that pipeline's more blocked up than Keystone is. They've got a record number of public comments. The Canadian government itself just announced an extra year of environmental review for that thing. The activists there are doing an amazing job, and they're led by the what Canadians call First Nations people, Indigenous people, who have rallied in remarkable numbers and with great strength to say, you're not coming through our territory.
Right. So basically, in Canada, people have stood up, and the parade got, you know, my old cliche is that, you know, we don't elect leaders, we elect representatives, and that they pretend to be leaders. When they see a big enough parade going by, they jump out in front of it, hoist a flag, and say, this is my parade. And therefore, we've got to generate the parade. So the Canadians generated the parade, and the Canadian politicians are saying, okay, we're not going to do a pipeline to the West Coast. In America, you got arrested in front of the White House with a number of other very, very good people, and there's been a lot of discussion about this in a lot of venues, and that has created a parade that the president has responded to, as you point out, with some bravery. I think it's amazing that I did an op-ed last week or the week before on how dare the head of the Petroleum Institute threaten the president of the United States, and it looks like Obama is going to say to him, you know, I'll see your threat and raise it.
The next stop on this is taking on the fossil fuel industry's harem in Congress. We're going there on Tuesday to Capitol Hill. There'll be 500 or so of us in referees' shirts out there blowing the whistle on this collusion. We've been cynical enough to take for granted the idea that Congress, you know, oil companies should be allowed to give campaign donations and to people who are going to judge their interests. It's no different than bribing the refs at the Super Bowl, and
yep,
we're not going to let it happen anymore.
Okay, so, and you can learn all about that at 350.org. Bill McKibben, Thanks so much, Bill, for being
with us.
Thanks
as always, brother. Take care.
Good talking with you. Thank you. And coming up tomorrow, we will be broadcasting live from USA Families here in Washington, D.C. So be there, be square, and don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there and get active. Tag, you're it. Occupy something.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.